This podcast is already doing wonders for my credibility down the pub, Helen. I spent longer than I should telling my friends all about strap ends after our last episode.
Well, I hope they were very grateful. I hope you went into every detail possible.
I had no choice. I absolutely did.
I don't think I told you that medieval books had dear little belts as well, with their own little strap ends.
Medieval books had little belts.
We'll have to go into medieval books at some point. Yeah, the archaeology of the book is fascinating.
Oh, I learned so much, and that is what I love. Hopefully going to do it all again on this edition of the Time Team Podcast.
Yes, welcome to another edition of the Time Team Podcast. I'm Dr. Helen Geek, and that's Martin Williams. And before we get going on this episode, a quick word about the next one. We're going to be bringing you to the heart of an actual Time Team dig.
Yeah, we're really excited about this one. We're going to be on site at a dig. We do have to be a little bit secretive about where exactly we are and what exactly is going on. I think we're allowed to say at the moment that there are ancestral links to a very famous mouse, I think, is probably as much as I can say. But what we can do when we're there is bring you a sense of the atmosphere. Plus, we're going to be surrounded by loads of people from the Time Team family who are going to be sharing their expertise, their thoughts as well on the dig, on things that you might just have watched on YouTube about what they're researching. So it's all, I think, it's all tying together rather nicely. And I think it's going to be something a little bit different for you on the podcast.
So that's the next episode. But how about this one? Well, coming up, we're on to part three of Martin's chat with the man who created Time Team back in the 1990s, Tim Taylor. And that's getting really interesting because Tim's remembering the moment that Sir Tony Robinson became involved in the project. And also, you'll find out about the site that people are calling England's Pompeii. And there are a load more questions that you've sent through on Patreon after the last episode, and I'm going to do my best to answer them at the end of this podcast.
First, though, it's time to check in with another member of the team who I've promised that you're going to be hearing a fair bit from, actually, over the next few episodes. Stuart Ainsworth is Time Team's landscape archaeologist, and it's his job to use, well, all sorts of processes, really, as well as technology, to analyse a site well before anyone actually sets foot there.
You might remember hearing Stuart show Martin his vast collection of maps in the episode called Shakespeare's Hidden Stage. But in this episode, you'll learn more about a technology called LiDAR. So what is it, and how can it reveal a landscape's secrets? Well, Martin's been back at the University of Chester with Stuart to find out.
LiDAR is an incredible tool for landscape archaeologists to investigate a lot of the things that you can see on the ground, but they're very small features. And we can see very large areas very, very quickly. I just zoomed out across about 10 square kilometres of Chester. LiDAR is an acronym for light detection and ranging. It's a bit like radar. On the aircraft, this scanner sending out millions of pulses a second, and all that can create a three-dimensional image of everything those pulses hit on the ground.
The first impression of this is it's an aerial photograph. It looks like a photograph. But then when you look a little bit closer, you can start to see some of the details that you'd never be able to see if you were looking at this with your eyes.
That's right. And that's because it's effectively in three dimensions. Here, for instance, we can even see the types of ploughing.
There are these parallel lines that are running right the way down the length of this field. And I'm guessing then that is to do with the farming that was done here.
It is indeed. I mean, you've actually got quite a keen eye, I will say that, Martin, already. Oh,
thank you.
You're a good pupil today, as it were. It's almost like a pattern that it's almost like somebody laid corduroy trousers across the landscape, isn't it? They're that sort of like little ribs going across the landscape. And this is a type of ploughing that is typical of the medieval period, and it's called ridge and furrow ploughing.
And what would you be able to use that information to determine?
If you had medieval ploughing that you could see ran over something, the thing it runs over has got to be earlier than the medieval period.
So you get an idea of the chronology.
Absolutely. And that's really where landscape archaeology starts to become like a crime scene investigation.
Shall we compare this to the real world?
That's my language you're talking there, yeah. I mean, you have to look at the ground, to look at the reality. And before we go, Martin, I know we're both itching to get out. I want you to capture this image that you're looking at in your mind now with all these stripes of medieval ploughing and different patterns and the road. We will drive down this road. Look at that feature there. Perhaps we won't say too much about this at the moment, but we'll have a look at this on the ground. Come on, tell me what you think it is.
I can see it's a big feature of raised land. It doesn't seem to fit in with the lines of the ploughing. As to what it is, I'm not sure I could tell you.
Well, let's wait and see.
And coming up later on in the episode, Martin and Stuart are going to get their wellies on and head out to find out if they can use the LiDAR data to help them decipher what's happening at an archaeological site in real life.
I'm finding this all just so interesting. How much, Helen, of a game changer is LiDAR for archaeology?
Well, it's absolutely revolutionary. It's as revolutionary as aerial photographs were in their day, or even geophysics. You know, it is a completely new and different way of seeing a landscape on a huge scale. So it can reveal those subtle aspects, as Stuart said, that you can't see and you can't even feel as you walk across them. Or it can reveal features that have been obscured by modern plough soil. But it can also be used in those situations where you just can't do any survey. Things like dense woodland. And then the real game changer about LiDAR is that it's got these really clever algorithms for the removal of vegetation, tree cover, whether there's leaves on the trees or it's conifer forest or whatever. It can magically see through the trees or the scrub in a way that, of course, aerial photographs just can't. And it's all open source. It's all on the Environment Agency's website. You can just get stuck in. Just have a go yourself. But ultimately, you do still need to get out on the ground to see what's really happening. Part of that is because LiDAR produces a flat picture, like a map, so you don't see the hills and the valleys and the views. And really, in the end, there's no substitute as with geophysics. You can't just look at the picture. You've got to do a bit of ground truthing via excavation if you really want to know what's going on.
Well, keep listening to the podcast because very soon I'm going to do just that. I'm going to relate what I saw on the screen to what I saw in real life. That is coming up very, very soon. First, though, it's been described as England's Pompeii, a Bronze Age settlement which was home to up to 60 people, burned down in 850 BC. The Cambridgeshire site has been unearthed and is giving archaeologists a unique insight into what life was like 3,000 years ago.
Let's welcome Mark Knight to the Time Team podcast. He's Senior Project Officer at the Cambridge Archaeological Unit. Mark, what do you think about people calling Must Farm England's Pompeii?
It's a blessing and a curse, I think. I think it's very immediate in its description. But as a metaphor, we don't have any volcanoes. But I suppose it's the idea of the Pompeii premise, the sense that we have a settlement that was abandoned, unplanned, and therefore it captures pretty much everything intact.
And how come it was all so perfectly preserved? I mean, it seems to me, I spent a brief time working with Francis Pryor at Flag Fen, and it seems to me that it's a completely different order to those nearby waterlogged sites like Flag Fen. It's something utterly unique.
Yeah, there's a combination of factors. So we're in a river channel and we're in river sediments, and the sediments are very fine grained, so they're completely non-porous. So they are absolutely perfect preservation for organic remains. We also have a settlement that basically was built and burnt down within 9 to 12 months. So there's this sort of clarity of context. There's a sense that there's no superimposition or other archaeology. It's just the settlement. It collapses into the river channel. So it goes from being carbonized to being waterlogged and then to being sealed meters below the surface. So if you wanted an ideal scenario of preservation of an archaeological site, then the Must Farm is it.
You're talking there, though, about quite a bit of destruction. I mean, it's fallen down, it's become submerged. So what is there left to see? What does it look like?
There's a kind of architectural collapse called a pancake collapse, which is where, in effect, a building goes, roof hits floor, and then the floor hits the ground, and the whole thing sort of collapses vertically. And that's what happened to our settlement. The weight of the roofs and the burning of the lightweight floors and walls allowed these structures to basically collapse straight down. There's a mess that we had to excavate, but we could identify roof rafters and floor joists. We could see where structures were and where the middens were forming around them. So again, the brevity of the settlement gave us this sort of contextual sort of cleanness, I suppose, which is so unused to in archaeology. Archaeology is always partial, but also there's interference, and there wasn't with this site.
And it's not just the buildings, is it? Because you've been discovering items, objects, and I've seen some of the images of those. Maybe you could talk a little bit about what you found and maybe what that tells you about what life was like.
We excavated the site expecting to find a sort of generic platform, and we found five individual houses. Each of those houses still had their roofs on, in effect. We took off the roofs and we found the contents of those buildings. All of the pots, the metalwork, textiles, loom weights, spindle whorls, wooden troughs, buckets, hafted tools, a complete inventory of a single household. And then you go and dig the next structure and you've got pretty much a sort of identical template. Again, there's this sense of a complete picture of settlement. So when we talk about the objects, we can present a whole pot or a piece of textile or a bobbin with yarn wound around it, but we can do that repeatedly. So there's a sense also of magnitude or scale of just how much stuff people had at that time.
It's absolutely fascinating, the amount of stuff that you have found. The question I wanted to ask is, of course, we're talking to you now, not because Muss Farm has just been discovered, but because you've just finished the analysis and the writing up. So now is a perfect time to ask those kind of slightly bigger questions. And the really big question for me is, how much should we see this as just an ordinary, everyday snapshot of life in the Bronze Age? Because having worked on Flag Fen and knowing a bit about how the Fen archaeology is seen, a lot of the time it feels like everybody sees everything as being ritual. Most of us aren't so interested in the extraordinary and the unusual. What we're interested in is the everyday, the ways of life in the past. Is Muss Farm the kind of holy grail of the perfectly preserved ordinary site, or was it extraordinary in the Bronze Age?
I'd like to think the former. I'd like to think that we are seeing routine, pattern, every day, that sense of what it was like to be living in the middle of the 9th century in the Fens. I'd like to think that what we found is representative of what else is out there. We're the first people to excavate a river channel at any scale, at any depth within the Fenland. And we're doing it because it's a brick quarry. Our aperture was fortuitous. It's part of development and things. So we didn't dig it because we had some great insight that the best preserved Bronze Age settlement site would be there. What we're seeing is part of the broader pattern of Fenland landscape itself, I think. And I agree with your question, really. In the past, if we found metalwork in a watery context, we'd put it down to some grand gesture, some moment of some sort of special deposition and things. And no, what we're suggesting is that perhaps a lot of what's been found in the Fens is actually representative of routine. And that metalwork was, I don't know, for want of a better term, sort of disposable, in a sense that there was a lot of it and everyone had much of that material as well. So I think that answers your question.
Yes, that makes it so much more exciting for me, so that we can populate our Bronze Age world with not just, I mean, to be honest, it tends to be blokes making flint tools and axes, chopping down trees, going hunting, fighting.
Boring.
This is people. well, it's a partial picture at the best. And this adds in people who are bringing up children, making clothes, making the dinner. Everybody's got to be fed. You've got to not just have the ingredients for tonight's dinner, but you've got to be thinking about grinding the wherewithal for tomorrow and the next month and storing over the winter. You've got to be making your pot in order to make the dinner. All human life is there. And these are people who are not too dissimilar from us. They just have more challenges and have to be more self-sufficient. It's just a jump across the centuries. I just find it absolutely extraordinary.
These people were thriving. This isn't survival mode. This isn't people at the margins. These people are at the centre of the late Bronze Age, and they have an abundance of material. And I think that, to me, I think is the implication of our project, is that there was a lot of stuff. Whereas previously, perhaps we were only allowing them one or two pieces of metalwork and a single bead or something like that. And yet when we actually get to see past settlement preserved in such perfection, there's this real sense of stuff, of a real material world where, and a real sense, I think, also to go with that. And there's an aesthetic. These people cared about what they looked like, or the vessels that they ate out of, or the structures that they lived within. It was more than just getting by, I think. So, yeah, really important. I agree with you. It's so nice to be able to be talking about, for want of a better term, the ordinary.
Yes, and that we shouldn't be focusing in on the things that they didn't have, like central heating and flushing loos or whatever. What we should be doing is be looking at what they did have. They had those connections and that sophistication, and that it was quite ordinary to have things coming in from thousands of miles through gift exchange and all the subtle informal or formal mechanisms, but they didn't include money. I mean, it's almost like a visit to another planet. It shows us that things haven't always been the same, things don't always have to be the same, and that you can live in a hugely different way, but it's equally good.
Mark, that was brilliant, and we could talk, I think, all day about what some of the discoveries are and what that tells us about life in the Bronze Age. But it sounds to me like you will have your work cut out for you for some time, making further investigations into some of the discoveries that you made.
Yeah, you know, we want to find Moss Farm too. We want to show that this is not an anomaly, this is pattern.
The work goes on. Mark, thank you so much for coming on.
No worries, thank you very much.
And if you want to see some of these remarkably preserved objects, including pottery and textiles and jewellery, plus a kind of artist's impression of what life was like 3,000 years ago, then what you need to do is head over to Peterborough Museum for a free exhibition, but it does close soon. It's only on till Saturday the 12th of October. So this is a really rare chance to see these things up close.
This is the Time Team Podcast, and a quick reminder that Helen is going to be answering your questions at the end of this episode, so thank you so much for getting them to us. If you would like to ask a question to Helen, then the way to do it is through Patreon. So you head to patreon.com/timeteamofficial, and if you do decide to support us there, by the way, you'll not only get the chance to ask questions here on the podcast, but you'll also have access to a huge amount of extra content from Time Team. What can people do on there, Helen?
Well, there is so much. There's exclusive Patreon-only videos, which give you much more insight into what we've been getting up to. And this weekend, Digwatch is going to be going behind the scenes at our latest archaeological 3-day excavation. So you'll be able to follow the action as it happens. And you can only do that on Patreon. Then there's the opportunity to get your hands dirty, actually join us on an excavation. But best of all, I think, is that being a Patreon member gives you that warm feeling that you can only get when you know that you're helping to fund archaeology and education across the UK and, in fact, the whole world. Because your support helps us pay for all the excavations we do, all the research, all the events we put on to get out into the community and infuse people with archaeology and with history.
Yeah, your money is very, very well used, goes to a really great cause and a great operation, which is the whole kind of Time Team thing, which, as you, I think, are getting a bit of an idea of now, extends like a spider with tentacles to many areas of archaeology and community outreach and all that sort of stuff. So head there now if you want to help us with what we're doing, patreon.com/timeteamofficial. Now, let's get back to a little bit of Time Team nostalgia now, and you can't talk about Time Team for long before someone brings up its original host, Sir Tony Robinson. And I've been chatting with the show's creator, Tim Taylor, and he remembered when Tony became involved with the project.
I'd seen Tony, obviously, as we all had growing up, playing his lute, turning up on Blackadder. I was having a chat with Mick, and Mick said, "Oh, I know Tony, he's a friend." In fact, Tony went on an archaeology course, I think on Santorini, that Mick had created. And so there was a sort of friendship there. So the fact that Mick and Tony got on and we then went to meet Tony, it just felt very comfortable. Tony's ability to think on his feet. We don't really write scripts for Time Team. We get an approximate direction we hope to go in. But by day one, we've pretty much thrown that, ripped that up, and we're taking it as it comes. And for some people, that's quite a difficult process. We actually do it spontaneously, and having Nick dance as cameraman, Tony as presenter, Mick's willingness to, you know, respond to things as they happen, gave it that kind of flow. And I always trusted that. If you watch Time Team, there's some really long takes as we follow what's happening, because to be honest, nobody knew. And that was quite traumatic on occasion. But, you know, we all worked together on it and rather enjoyed it. And it felt like real archaeology.
And it was hugely popular. What do you think it was that captured the public's imagination?
I think it's always that idea of when you're looking at the landscape and you see a hill or something, or a wood, or a strange ancient path, or a kink in a boundary that appears to be there for no reason. We think, well, why was that like that? And it doesn't take very much in England to just wander off the beaten track and suddenly somehow feel the spirits of the past in the air. It's like you suddenly look at a site and you want to know what its origins were. And archaeology is this marvelous thing which gives you a chance to look at the evidence and try and say what the past was. It's an adventure, and it's like discovering the treasures of history in the past and their objects. It's tactile, and I think people like that. And also the fact that we got on very well and there was a lot of humour.
The team element is something that has really been wonderful to watch.
Yes, and they were all perfectly capable of taking the mickey out of each other in various ways as well. So you could see they'd be keeping an eye open on somebody else and what they were going to say. Or, you know, Mick was going to tear a strip off someone because he went in the trench without asking him. Or Mick would suddenly disappear because he wanted to take the helicopter and go and look for a particular church he was interested in. I mean, we had some fairly chaotic moments. But underneath it all, there was also the process of doing the archaeology. So we had wonderful people who recorded what we did. You can't just dig holes in archaeology and then go away. You need to record what you see, write a report on it. And we had people, a lot of the time from Wessex Archaeology, who recorded what we were actually doing. If you dig holes and you don't record, you don't do the proper work of archaeology, then it doesn't matter whether it's a television program or not. In those 3 days, we had to record what we did. And there's something like 250 reports groaning on shelves. They're all digital now, of course, where the precise detail of what we did, what we found, is there for people to look at in the future.
That's Time Team's creator, Tim Taylor, and there'll be more from him and the Time Team backstory in future episodes of the podcast. Well, Martin, that was a pretty good analysis of what made Time Team such an immediate success. But I was also really glad to hear Tim talk about the nuts and bolts of archaeology, if you like. Things like, if you dig a hole and you see those layers and relationships and features without recording them, they are destroyed. You only get the one chance to see those things. So they have to be recorded at the time. But because we had to be doing the digging and the filming, we always had to ensure that the recording didn't get compromised. And that's why we always had, and still have, those team members whose only job is to do this. So they will never get swept up into a helicopter, never get asked to interview a visiting professor. They can always keep their heads down in the notebooks and the photographs and the drawings, the sections, the plans, the surveying, and so on and so forth. And then afterwards, do the analysis. So it all gets written up for posterity.
Yeah, and I guess it just highlights as well how important it is for future generations, but also at the time, to do it right. This is proper, you know, it's proper archaeology, and that means doing it properly, recording it properly, so that future generations can find out more about what was unearthed on any of the Time Team digs that you might have watched.
Well, that's right. You can't just ask a future researcher to watch a television program and try to work out what's been going on.
No. I'm sure they'd enjoy it, but no, I think they need
not
to be
quite enough.
No, you do need to see it written down. Now, earlier on, you heard me and Time Team's landscape archaeologist Stuart Ainsworth discussing LIDAR. It's a technology which uses millions of sort of pulses of light. They're fired at the ground from an aircraft, and they create this really detailed image of the ground. And Stuart's been explaining how that technology can help archaeologists build up a picture of a landscape before they even set foot there.
But the proof of the pudding, of course, is in the eating. So after looking at a LiDAR image of a field outside Chester, Martin and Stuart jumped in the car to go and take a look at it in real life.
Welcome to the Mapmobile. Yep, we're going ahead just a few miles south of Chester. And we're going to follow up that image we were looking at on the computer screen, the one with the LiDAR. Turn that off. You're keeping that image in your head, Martin, I hope.
I am, yeah.
And we'll go and have a look at the field with those earthworks in it and see how that site starts to reveal itself and putting together the images you've seen. And with all that information, we can then start to interrogate the ground, look at the reality. And that's when it starts to get more and more like real archaeology and real investigation. Looks like you've had plenty of practice there. It's half the battle being a landscape archaeologist. It's got nothing to do with maps, and it's about managing gates and fences and hedges and all the obstacles before you even get to where you want to go.
But here we are. This is the... almost slipped in the mud. Here's the field that we were looking at on the LiDAR, and already I can see those features. I can see the lumps and the bumps in this field.
Look at the evidence. Don't try and put it into any time slot, into any category. Analysis of everything that you see, the trees, the field, and what the ground's telling you, and what those images you've got in your head from the LiDAR are telling you. You're continually working with them as evidence.
These lumps and bumps then, Stuart, this is ploughing.
These are strips which have been ploughed into the soil over generations and generations to create this pattern of what looks like corduroy on the landscape. These ridges are created by usually an ox team. As the ox team goes down, the plough behind is piling up the soil that way. Eventually you get a ridge. And these are absolutely typical size and typical form of medieval ridge and furrow ploughing.
So we know that was going on in this field. The other thing is this mystery, and I can see the mystery maybe a few hundred metres away from where we are now, and that's this big sort of ridge feature that we saw on the LiDAR, and I didn't know what it was. So shall we have a little walk over there and see if I can get any more clues?
It's really boggy.
This is a really boggy bit.
As we walk along this ridge line, we can see once we've got to it, it dips down again the other side, doesn't it? It's a massive, massive wide feature that's very, very low. Let's behave like a landscape archaeologist. I want you to get down on the ground now.
Okay.
Okay, I'm not used to this on radio, sort of crawling okay. down.
We're on the ground.
I actually to get you down on your knees. Come on.
Okay, I'm here.
I'm lying flat on the ground. One does in the
it's intro. Wet down here.
It's wet, yeah, right. Now, look, we're on top of the ridge. Can you see now that there's a ridge on top of the ridge, but that ridge is now running away from us? That's the kind of detail that you start to look for as a landscape archaeologist. And with the LiDAR, we can exaggerate that and see these features much more clearly. But it looks here that we've got a plough ridge on top of this feature. So what does that tell you, Martin?
That the ridge was here first.
Brilliant. Right, you can get up now.
I can get up now. So, now I've really got to know this feature. What am I looking at?
This big ridge underneath continues all the way for at least another 300-400 metres and then curves back down towards the river. It's like a big enclosure with an open end on the riverside. And this type of feature is really quite rare and unusual. It's effectively a fortification, probably mid to late 9th century in date, may go well into the mid 10th century. We know that from the excavated material. Could we have said that without that excavation? I said, that's a key question. Could we have dated it by looking at the landscape and the way we're looking at it? And we could have got very close to that, because we would say, from the evidence even that you've seen today, that it predates the medieval period, because it predates medieval ploughing. Then you compare its size and its location and its form with other sites that are known of a similar period. This site fits very comfortably with a number of other sites that have been excavated that you know they're of that date. So you're comparing what you see with something that you know.
So you've been crawling around on Viking Age ramparts, Martin.
Yes, I have. And I have to say, I wasn't prepared to get actually down on the floor on my belly. And it was quite wet that day, and we were in a very muddy field, and I came away needing to put all my clothes in the wash, is what I'll say.
Yes, there's no such thing as the wrong weather or the wrong soil conditions, only the wrong clothing.
That's it. And that is something I learned very well.
I found it really interesting that Stuart talked about being able to exaggerate the vertical dimension of the LiDAR data. And in fact, you can manipulate the data in all sorts of ways to make it easier to see things. I mean, one of the great things about LiDAR is that technologically you can move the lighting around. So you can change where the sun is, in effect, to be able to see more. It's just such an extraordinary technology. It's given us so much more to go and investigate. You know, there are so many undated earthworks that time teams often ask to go and investigate. We can't always do it, but LiDAR reveals something. It could be Neolithic, or it could be Iron Age, or it could even be Viking Age, like that one outside Chester that you went to see. There's just no way of telling until you go and ground truth it.
I often wonder, is it that archaeologists sort of rely now too much on technology? There's so much technology around that you think, I don't really need to go. And I've always thought, well, surely, you know, the best thing to do is to go and dig something. And I'm sure that is the case. But actually, this is proof that technology can help in ways that being there on the ground and digging can't. It's not a substitute for it, but it's an excellent complement.
As they say, time spent in reconnaissance is seldom wasted.
All right, almost the end of the podcast now, which means it is time for your questions. Thank you so much. If you've been on Patreon and you've got in touch with questions for Helen, this went down a real storm last time, and we're hoping it's going to do the same this episode. If you want to ask a question, you do have to be a Patreon member. It's one of the benefits that you get is the opportunity to question an actual archaeologist for real. So head there now, patreon.com/timeteamofficial if you want to ask a question for the next episode. We need as many as we possibly can. Let's get on to this then. Debbie Gerlock, actually asked two questions. Debbie, I shall save your second question for another episode, but here's your first one, and I think this is brilliant. Since the sun rises and sets in different locations throughout the year, does this affect the direction a burial is aligned, and does that help to figure out when the person was buried? This is such a good question, because I guess, and you could work out, is if the sun's rising and setting in a different place in the winter and then a different place in the summer, and a burial is aligned in a certain way, could you say, we reckon that person was probably buried in January?
Yeah, that is such a good question. And in fact, Debbie, you're not actually the first person to wonder about that. This was first brought up, as far as I know, in the 1960s. The theory is that there's almost always an aim for east-west, something to do with the movement of the sun. The question then is how you establish which way is east, which way is west, and exactly the line on which to begin to dig your grave. There were all sorts of diagrams published for large cemeteries that showed those precise orientations and the statistical variability and the limits of where the sun would rise and set at the solstices. But in the end, after all this work, all this data gathering was done, it seems that there's generally, in fact, just a normal distribution, a kind of bell curve around some particular direction for any particular cemetery. So the people who are digging the graves are aiming at an alignment with something handy that is roughly giving them an east-west direction. They're not sighting every individual grave on the sunrise.
So what we're saying then really here is that they have an approximate, we think that's east or we think that's west,
They're not sort of changing where the orientation based on the time of the year. They're just kind of, yeah, we reckon that's sort of roughly east, and then everybody's going to be buried in that orientation from here on in.
Yeah, I suppose an analogy might be that on archaeological sites, there's often something called site north, which is based on a landmark or a boundary. And we think that's exactly the way that people are doing it in the past and burial sites. It's cemetery east that they're aiming for rather than true east or sunrise east.
There you go then, Debbie. Hope that clears that up for you. Let's move on to our second question for this episode. It comes from Julianne, who says, this is such a basic question. Now, see, Julianne, there's no such thing as a silly question. There's no such thing as a basic question. But that's what Julianne says. This is such a basic question. I'm almost embarrassed to ask. Do not be embarrassed. How do things get buried? I've been trying to figure out how entire settlements can end up under multiple meters of earth. Do you know what? I've thought this before as well, Julianne. Where is this soil coming from that suddenly builds up and up and up so that your thing is now underground?
Well, these basic questions are often the ones that need asking the most. And there's really two ways of answering this question. The first one would be to play devil's advocate a bit and say, well, what would happen if the entire settlement didn't end up under multiple metres of earth? What would happen if it didn't get buried at all? And the answer is it wouldn't survive. So archaeology's got to be protected by something to allow it to survive. But then the second question is, where does this earth come from? I say, well, do you have a garden and do you have to sweep the leaves and so on away from your paths and your paving? And what would happen if you didn't? Leaves, it's detritus, it's all the mess that builds up on hard surfaces. Another thing is worms. And worm action brings up soil and it buries surfaces and it buries objects. So the more worms you have, the more build-up you're going to get. The bigger things, that what causes a settlement to be buried under metres, is things like hill wash and soil blow. So you can get wind and heavy rain that literally does wash soil down slopes, taking it from some places and putting it on others. I think what you have to do, Julianne, is you have to keep looking while you're out in your garden or the edges of roads, watch people removing the soil and keeping those surfaces clear.
And also blame the worms.
That's true.
I like the fact that the worms are getting involved in archaeology as well and preserving it. It feels like it's their duty. They're preserving things for future generations to find. So we thank them for that. Thank you so much for the questions. We'll do that all again in the next episode. I just want to bring you this. I want to finish with this comment here from Min La Vida, who got in touch also on our Patreon. He says, brilliant podcast. Thank you. Oh, thank you, Min. Very kind of you. How lovely to be able to listen to Helen for half an hour. Helen, you should narrate some audiobooks, preferably about archaeology, of course. I love that idea, Min, and I thought maybe we need to launch some sort of time team short story competition, Helen.
Oh, that would be just so lovely. I really, really enjoy reading out loud. It's one of the best ways, I think, to enjoy anything from a short story to a long novel. And I loved reading to my children when they were little. They're unfortunately too big now. We finished with a full reading of the entire Harry Potter series, and I just adored doing that. So I would love somebody to offer me the chance to read a book out loud. It would just be so nice. But thank you so much for your questions. And if you've got one for me, then get over to Patreon, where you can comment on the post about this podcast, or you can send a direct message to ask me anything you like. And really, the most basic ones are the ones that make me think the most. So I love them.
And thank you as well for taking time to listen to this episode of the Time Team podcast. We're going to be back next time with that very, very special episode we're recording on a Time Team dig. So there's going to be loads to enjoy as part of that episode. We don't really know what's going to be going on yet. We don't know what's going to happen. It could be, Helen, complete chaos.
It very well could be. I mean, on Time Team, we never know what's going to happen. So it's always complete chaos. But it is definitely one that will be worth listening to next time.
We will speak to you on our next episode then of the Time Team podcast. Goodbye.
Bye for now.